cooperation over chaos. We are all in this together.
The Sustainable Hour.
For green, clean, sustainable Geelong. The Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Air Podcast. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those that earn that great honour in the future. We acknowledge that this is going out in NAIDOC Week. We had Professor Mark Rose on last week talking about the importance of us using the accumulated wealth of ancient wisdom that they've gathered by nurturing both their land and their communities for millennia before their land was stolen. Land that always was and always will be First Nations land.
You're right to be angry about your power bill, how it's gone up and up. And you're right to be angry about cost of living. Like, just a cup of coffee now is $7 in many of the cafes. But what I don't understand is, why don't you ask, who should I be angry at? Who is profiting from this? And who is laughing all the way to the bank at the moment? So we hear politicians trying to scare you about net zero, which is something they say is running our country down. And they want you to believe that renewables are a hoax and that it's just some sort of an expensive fantasy which is being pushed by inner city latte drinking elites. But hey, let's just once more take a look at this claim. Give me a moment, because I would like to talk about a small village in Germany called Feldheim. It's a village of about 130 people. And it's not some trendy city suburb with latte drinking greenies. No, this is a rural village in Germany with farmers, local families, ordinary people. And what did they do? They built their own renewable energy system with wind turbines and solar panels and a biogas plant, which is using the local farm waste. And of course, some batteries, a local heating network, and they have their own electricity grid. And what did they get out of doing that? These 130 residents in Feldheim now pay around 19 cents per kilowatt hour for their electricity. 19 cents. That's about half of what most Australian households here pay for our electricity. So next time you hear a politician tell you that renewables are expensive, how about you ask them, how come the people in Feldheim pay half of what we Australians are paying? And what you should probably then be asking yourself is, why did those people in Germany choose to become energy independent? When someone tells you that local people get nothing out of this green energy transition, maybe you should ask them, who owns the system? And where does the money go? Who's benefiting? Because that is the real question to ask. In Germany, in Feldheim, it's the local citizens who own the energy system. The real choice we have is between an old energy system where we ordinary people keep paying our bills to large companies and a new system where we, communities, farmers, households, small businesses and so on, own the system. And in that way, we are all becoming part of the solution. That's what Feldheim shows us. That's what happens when community is brought in rather than pushed aside, as we see it happening here in Australia. The energy is produced locally, the money stays local. So the bills are half price and the supply is more secure. When gas prices went up and up in Europe because of the war in Ukraine, in Feldheim, the energy prices didn't go anywhere. They stayed where they were, unchanged. Energy security will not come from digging up more coal or drilling for more gas. Energy security means using what we here in Australia have in abundance, the sun, the wind, land, and skills. We have the engineers, electricians, and the rooftops. So I suggest, like Pauline Hanson says we should get ideology out of the way and look at the numbers and the facts. And it's now a fact that all around the world, new solar and wind are cheaper than new fossil fuel power generation. Here in Australia, we have our own energy market operator saying that the cheapest path forward is renewable energy. That's not green ideology. That's system planning. And sure, that transition costs some money, it does. Every piece of new infrastructure costs money. When we build new roads, it costs. New hospitals. Or if we build a new coal plant, that costs money too, or nuclear power for that matter. It all costs. Last year, the fossil fuel companies would have picked our pockets in the tune of an extra $690 billion if we didn't have renewables. In other words, we've saved almost $700 billion last year just because of renewable energy. So this net zero thing is not something being done to us, as Pauline Hanson talks about. It's actually something that we need. So when you're thinking about what things cost, yeah, sure, stay angry. But aim your anger at the right target, please. You could be angry that Australia has so much free sunshine and there's so many people who can't afford their power bills. You could be angry that communities are being shut out of decisions that affect their land. You could be angry that energy companies are making profit. Angry that Canberra politicians are turning energy policy into some culture war, telling you that renewables are a hoax. There's a lot to be angry about, for sure. But the answer is not to kill the green transition. The answer is to make it fairer, smarter, more local, more democratic. Just like they did in Feldheim in Germany. We have to stop letting this anger be used against our own future. You're right to be angry about these power bills and the cost of living, but you also need to be angry at politicians who think they can get away with lying. In America, they have Trump. He gets away with it, yes. We don't need another Trump here in Australia, honestly. We have to demand that politicians stop lying to us. And you would think that would have been the most natural job for the media people, the journalists who sat and listened to Pauline Hanson when she spoke at the press club the other week. And then when it got to Q&A time, what did they do? Nothing. Not a single journalist held her to account. No one confronted her with the facts. But at least here in the Sustainable Hour, we do like facts. And as most of our listeners know, every week we deliver a smorgasbord of global facts, scientific findings for you, and the story about what's actually going on out there in the real world, the fast-moving real world, which is important. So over to you, Colin Market, OAM, who has once again been keeping a sharp eye on the facts that are cropping up beyond our Aussie horizon. And what do you have on the smorgas menu today, Colin?
Well, thank you, Mick. Yes, and that all of that rant serves as an introduction because it fits in perfectly with my roundup for this week, which begins in Geneva at the headquarters of the World Health Organization. Now, that's a branch of the UN of which every nation of the world is a member. The WMO released a paper last week that was headlined that the world is entering a new era of heat. It described global emergency that is already killing people, straining societies, but most surprisingly, it pointed the finger of blame at the world's journalists for the way that global media reports extreme weather. The paper began with the deadly heat that has been sweeping across Europe. The WHO figures estimate that at least 1,300 people have died across Europe so far, as countries such as France and Germany have endured some of the hottest temperatures they've ever recorded. But Europe is not an isolated case. North America is now facing similar danger. Around 250 million Americans are experiencing dangerous heat waves with temperatures comparable to those recently seen in Europe. And Europe is expected to face another round of extreme heat before September. The briefing made clear that this is not a regional weather problem. It's a global climate problem, from North Africa to South America. Asia, China, Japan, and Korea are all experiencing their hottest summers on record. In May, India was home to 97 of the world's 100 hottest cities, with temperatures between 45 and 48 degrees. It's almost beyond thinking about. These are not just uncomfortable numbers, they're conditions that threaten human survival, especially for people engaged in outdoor work. This is what the report said. In India, roughly three-quarters of their workforce, that's around 380 million people, work in heat-exposed sectors, such as agriculture and construction. For these workers, extreme heat is a daily physical threat. It affects their ability to earn a living, to stay healthy, and to simply survive. One of the most important points from the paper was that the heat is not experienced equally. Wealthier people can retreat indoors, turn on air conditioning, or adjust their work days. Poorer workers, outdoor labourers, elderly people, children, people with health conditions, and those living in poorly insulated homes face much greater risks. Extreme heat reveals social inequality as much as it reveals rising temperatures. Then it said, and I'm still talking about the WMO report, then it said that journalists have a direct role to play in saving lives. Civic-minded reporting could help people understand the risks, it said, by telling how to stay safe and recognise when heat has become dangerous. It said that journalism could help shape how people prepare for and respond to extreme weather. And that means providing timely, accurate and practical information. Who is most at risk? Where cooling areas are located? How to recognise heat stress? What employers should do to protect workers, and what authorities are doing or failing to do to protect their people. But then, the report urged, the best reporting should go further. It must explain why this heat is happening. Now here, it was blunt. It was the media's duty to report that burning fossil fuels has overheated the planet, it said. As a result, heat waves are becoming hotter, longer and more frequent. The planet has already warmed by about 1.4 degrees Celsius, and this level of warming is enough to produce deadly consequences. Scientists warn that temperatures will keep rising until humanity phases out the burning of fossil fuels. The report held its heaviest criticism for news reporting of extreme heat without mentioning that it was due to climate change. Given the state of climate science in 2026, the paper said, leaving out the climate connection is no longer defensible journalism. Now, with this in mind, The Age reported this week that Australia's biggest gas producers are poised to cash in on an expected $18 billion revenue surge over the next year. This is due to the fallout from the Iran war. This was reported in The Age's business section, saying that it intensified calls for the government to levy a 25% tax on their exports. The report made no mention of the effect of the world's climate that the eventual burning of that gas will have. The article said that before the outbreak of the war on February the 28th, the Australian government had announced or had anticipated a sharp decline in LNG export income from producers in Queensland, WA and the Northern Territory. Official forecasters have projected revenue dropping of about $50 billion in the 2027 financial year due to oversupply in a declining market. But instead, the latest government projections released last week reveal that liquid natural gas, or LNG, revenue is now expected to climb from $47 billion in the 2026 financial year to $65 billion in 2027, an increase of $18 billion compared to their prior forecast. Now, that was reported as an extra profit for the gas companies, not as affecting the atmosphere. But scientists estimate that burning that gas will produce between 57 to 78 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions, which would equal the entire emissions of a medium-sized country the size of Austria, or the annual emissions from operating 18 coal-fired power plants. Now, I found those figures once I realized how much gas was going to be coming up for $18 billion. It wasn't reported in the Age article at all. They simply commented about the money. Now, finally, the surge of electric vehicles in Australia continues despite fuel prices levelling out and going back to pre-Iran war levels. The Chinese car company BYD recorded selling an astonishing 18,881 vehicles in June. Now, that's up from 8,211 in May. Tesla sold 8,670 vehicles too, a new record. Altogether, more than 140,000 new cars were bought in Australia during June. Almost half, 49.8%, were electric. And that small piece of good news ends my roundup for the week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Our guest today is Nadia Scheffer. And Nadia is a blue economy entrepreneur based in Cape Town, South Africa. For the past decade, she's been investigating the potential of kelp and seaweed to transform the economy of her country. Along the way, she has observed some interesting dynamics of the global seaweed industry. So, Nadia, tell us how you got involved in this industry, your background, your influences, and see where that takes us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. My story is a little bit of an unusual one, so not coming from a science or a biology background. And it's a bit hard to describe why I'm completely obsessed. It's past just a fascination by this point, just obsessed with seaweed and kelp. So in 2015, I came down on holiday to Cape Town before moving down in 2017. Grew up in Pretoria, which is in the middle of the country, no ocean around. And while on holiday, walking on the beach, noticing something that I wasn't even sure what it was. And it was a lot of it washing up on the beach. So that was the kelp that I saw. And who knows why, I just became curious about it and thought, like, I wonder if you can make stuff out of this. And you know you're onto something new when Google can't tell you how to do it. So in 2015, Googling anything seaweed, kelp orientated, didn't find much information. And then by the time I moved down to Cape Town in 2017, I was driving around in the city more and noticing how much of the kelp washes up on the beach. And by 2018, 2019, I started experimenting with it. And even in that gap between the time when I started Googling around again, there was more products on the international side popping up. Some Danish designers created a chair out of kelp, like mushing it up and creating furniture out of it. And a lady called Julia Lohmann made these amazing installations where she stretches the seaweed into these panels. And then just started playing mad scientist, just experimenting with it. And my earrings is, and I had the honor of sending a pair home with Prince William after meeting him at the Earthshot Prize. It's been a very long meandering journey. and just going in different directions, different rabbit holes of seeing what's doable in the international space around it. And one of the elements of the international, the global seaweed industry that fascinates me the most is that whether you're setting up a startup in Africa, America, Europe, in the seaweed space, you're all on the same page. The issues are the same. So it's regulation, legislation, and then the conundrum of the funding. Because with seaweed, using the broad term from all the different species, the sky is the limit of the applications. You're looking at bioplastics, biofibers, biostimulants, food applications. It's like a baseline ingredient that's used in a variety of industries that you wouldn't necessarily even think there would be ingredients for it. Like in your toothpaste. Most people have already consumed seaweed and products that they're not even aware of.
When you say plastic, bioplastic, what's that? And does it work? Is it already available?
One of the big forerunners in that space, also linked to the Earthshot Prize, is Notpla. So they're based in the UK, and they're making a type of like film that coats the containers in the fast food industry. It is still a lot of early stage development around it. And I think when you're looking at a bioplastic, one of the challenges is to extend the period before it starts degrading. So you've got Notpla that's quite prominent. Sway is another one. And then there's a very interesting one actually down in your hood, Ulu, which I've only recently stumbled on. So they're based, I think it's in Tasmania, so ULUU, and they use a very unique fermentation process to also make bioplastic from. And I just this week I saw that they're on track with their scaling to get to a commercial level. So there's a lot of exciting movement in the industry, but it's seen as early stage, because you moving into new R&D, it's still like a long while to get it very commercialized and very established. At the moment, most traditional venture capitalists don't want to touch it yet, because you're working with a nature solution, so there's no complete guarantees. And then you get into the conundrum with climate change affecting a lot of the kelp forests around the world. In South Africa, we're lucky, we're in one of the natural upwelling zones. So our kelp is actually doing perfectly fine with the more turmoil. But it means the intensity of the storms is more, we just recently had a big one that devastated the coastline. And then on the opposite side, on California, the kelp forests are dying off because of the heating of the ocean.
Now, do you think because of that, they're thriving, is that a correct word, off your country, and not doing so well in others? I think in parts of Tasmania where they've grown freely for decades, a millennia probably, they're dying off. Do you think there's an attitude to have your country specialising in that, in seaweed products?
Yeah, so our local species, Eclonia maxima, is sorely sought after by China. So when I just got into the space and, fixing up my LinkedIn, not even having a website where I, claimed to be able to export big quantities, I had a Chinese businessman contacting me looking for 10 containers of the Eclonia maxima per month. So one of the big challenges, and just like globally with seaweed, is the loss of moisture. So when you're looking at the wet mass going to the dry mass, that's where things get sticky with scaling things up. Because depending on the species, you're looking up to 80, even 90% of moisture loss. So for a container, you have to scale that up. At the moment, our wild harvesting is still done very sustainably. You've got big companies like CalPAC and AfriKelp working with the biostimulant, and they've been in the space since the 1970s. So they basically use a system where in their designated area, they'll start harvesting on the one side, and then almost using like zebra stripes going through their zone and looping back again. And it can take up to 2 years for them to work through that zone. And by the time they come back, it's ready for harvest again. So one of the big elements that I want to establish in South Africa, and we're working on other African countries as well, is doing the local value add. Because at the moment, we're exporting the raw material out to China, and they're doing the extraction method, and we're actually importing the alginate, which is the gooey inside of the product that's been used in a very wide range of industries. So you're looking at food production, cosmetic, pharmaceutical, even in the construction industry, depending on what kind of grade of the product you're working with. That extraction can be done locally. I just recently partnered with a European company that's working on a system doing a biorefinery method, where we're going to be bringing the processing of the kelp and the seaweed as close as possible to the ocean to make sure that we get all of the wide range of compounds from the seaweed and the kelp.
And its capacity to draw down carbon, like seaweed generally, is that seen as a big plus for the industry as well?
It depends on which species you're harvesting. So for instance, the kelp, you basically like just cutting grass. So the main part of the plant will always remain there, and you're just using the top part, which grows really fast. Depending on the species, some of the giant kelp, which are Eclonia maxima, falls under, can grow up to 0.5 meters per day. So it's literally the fastest growing plant on the planet. So it's like, you can call it sea bamboo, same as with land bamboo, it grows really fast. So you will struggle to find a more sustainable resource. And because there's so many applications to it, it's really an exciting space. But with the carbon sequestering, the science is still very early stage. And to quantify, to see exactly how much is sequestered, it's still being investigated. But I think especially with the kelp species, where you're only taking the top part of the plant and most of the plants remain stable, it's definitely a space for sequestering. The other side is the biodiversity credits as well, which in Namibia, Kelp Blue is one of the big forerunners with that, investigating how to kind of add that onto their operations.
Just take us through, what does it mean to grow kelp? Because, you know, we understand how we know how farmers go out in the field and they, you know, drop some seeds and plants come up. But how do you do it underwater? Is it boats going out and are divers going down? How does it actually work? What does it look like?
So when I initially got onto the idea of just cultivating it as well, because that is the next phase, especially with our industry as well, with the demand growing so much, the cultivation is inevitable to be the next phase. I was kind of like, how difficult can it be to grow the plant? You just, you know, like you're thinking, just, you know, drop it in and there it goes. But some of the species are easier than others. Some you can cultivate with just like a little, you break a little piece off, you tie it onto a rope, you put it into the ocean and it just takes over. But the other ones, for instance, like our kelp, there's a big lab component in it. So the seaweed or the kelp works with spores that are released. So they actually take a little piece of the kelp and they like induce it to like release the spores, and then from there they have to nurse it in the lab conditions for quite a while. At the moment, mostly it's done with the seed line concept, where you have like this type of string or a rope where you want the kelp or the seaweed to latch onto it. I know they do the sugar kelp on the American coastline in a similar way, where you then wait for it to be stable in the lab and then you take it out to the ocean.
You mentioned before the fact that seaweed in some countries is dying. How general is that? I guess that's because of sea temperatures.
Yeah, that is quite, like, I know along the Australian side, it's something that they're monitoring quite a bit. I know in the American side, it's also that something that is getting into a concern. There is some people investigating what kind of science to use to counter that. I know, yep. Brian von Houtzen, I think trying to remember their company name now. So they've got a system where they can mimic what naturally happens for us with the... So the trouble is the nutrient-rich water is at the bottom and it needs to be circulated up. So that's why South Africa and Namibia, and there's five spots around the country, the globe that works on that system where it naturally circulates the nutrients, especially along the American coastline. That top layer is becoming so stagnant that with the ocean temperatures fluctuating so much, the kelp is really struggling.
And what potential development excites you the most around seaweed?
I think just accelerating a lot of the R&D. So just getting out of the loop of needing the grant funding to keep the industry going. Because that at the moment is most people's space of needing yet another application to keep the wheels going. I think the R&D of just all of these applications that's doable. I would say the biostimulant is one of the big fields that everybody is focusing on at the moment, specifically also with the tie in into agriculture. The bioplastic is also quite exciting, and I think the biofibers as well. The food production, changing people's palate to eat the kelp and the seaweed is quite a challenge. In South Africa there's some chefs that play around with the kelp, but it's a very acquired taste if you're not processing it into the food and almost using it as ingredient that people aren't aware of. So I think the food side is also showing a lot of promise. I know in the Europe context, there's a lot of research into one of the other species called ulva, which is sea lettuce. And there's a project called Wheat of the Sea, which is exploring, what can be done with the ulva. One of the big developments around that is a protein extract. So yeah, the sky's the limit. I kind of came up with the saying, tongue in cheek, whatever the question, seaweed is the answer. And it's not exaggerating. It's like a very, very versatile ingredient substance that can be used in various industries.
It sounds funny when you say the sky's the limit. The sea is the limit.
There you go. One of the challenges around the industry is that you're working with the foundation of the ecosystem. So you can't use the traditional business models of extraction on the kelp and the seaweed. So that's something for me it's interesting. The people that are drawn to the industry is not the typical business minds of just, as much profit as possible. For me, one of the main reasons why I've remained passionate about the industry is to know that this can genuinely make a dent in the fight against climate change. I mean, if you're looking, for instance, at the biostimulants and the biofertilizers, as soon as you replacing the negative or the bad industries with a new nature solution, you're already making a big dent there. Around the American coastline, ironically, like the kelp forest there is struggling, but because of all the nutrients that's washing into the ocean because of the agriculture overusing the fertilizer, they have the sargassum blooms. I don't know if you guys have seen any of those images of how much of it washes up.
Yeah, and that results in mass kills of fish and other sea critters.
Yeah, so that's, for instance, one of the conundrums with the, you know, it's seaweed, so that the name is, you know, is there for a reason. It under the perfect circumstance, it grows as a weed. So the sargassum is one of the examples of just seeing what the negative side of you know, too many different elements of the ecosystem not lining up. Because with that one, it's also a combination of the nutrients in the water, and all of a sudden the water temperature is changing. So some species will struggle with that, and other species will thrive.
So Nadia, it sounds to me like really there's a big solution to a serious problem that humanity is facing with the climate. And yet it's going a bit slow, isn't it? I mean, I've heard about kelp for more than a decade as a solution, but you're still talking about R&D, research and development. Why is it, you know, we have Elon Musk so interested in getting us to Mars. Why is Elon Musk not investing in kelp?
That would be amazing to get him on the, yeah, like heads up on that one. I think it is because you're working with nature, so it's not a guarantee. There's so much potential, even like if you, for instance, the species ulva can be cultivated on land, where with that one, especially for the food production, you need a system where you have 100% control over the whole system. So in South Africa, some of the big productions around that is done with the abalone industry, where they use a system called IMTA. So it's integrated multi-tropic aquaculture, where you basically just replicating what happens in nature. I mean, if you go out now into any garden or any forest, like you don't see just one species operating on its own. Everything's connected. It works together, and you know the science is there. It's a good question. Why are the bigger honchos like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos not taking notice yet? I think Jeff Bezos might have, if I remember correctly, he was involved potentially in some aquaculture in the Netherlands with wind farms there as well. I haven't kept track of that. So he's at least starting to pay a little bit of attention. Elon Musk is a bit of a unfortunate export of my country, I would say. I think he's such a mixed bag. Depending on who you're going to talk to, some people will say he's a genius and other people will say he's gone in the wrong direction. It's unfortunate that I want to say like money is not the problem. We have the money and the financing available. It's just, you know, having that switch of pure capitalism of you know, like making as much money and as quickly as possible versus, you know, just looking at that holistic picture around it. I mean, that's especially in the African context as well. Seaweed farming and kelp has got so much potential for like just increasing the livelihoods of people. One of my, she's like my like seaweed superstar to always mention in that context, Clara Schade, making beauty products in Zanzibar with the seaweed farmers there. So in Tanzania, the industry has been established for the last 30 years. But the trouble is you've got the raw material going out and someone else seeing all the benefits down the line. So Clara like took that business model, toppled it on its head, and with her system, she's increasing the livelihoods of the seaweed farmers, like predominantly female, by 900%. And that's just her not wanting to exploit her workers and make the most money as quick as possible. Using her product as an example, you know, it's very, very high-end bespoke cosmetics that you can't just put on the shelf and be like, okay, you know, compete with L'Oreal, compete with Revlon. I realized at the moment the story of seaweed is stronger than the numbers, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it seems like that would bring, if Clara, her approach to business is the opposite to what the approach to business that's got us in this mess that we're in at the moment. Yeah, so it's not pure capitalism. It's about the greater good, I guess.
Yeah.
Helping other people, yeah, making their lives better.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, talking about the R&D, depending on what kind of extraction process you're looking at, the low level, the biostimulants, even using in the animal feed. I know one of the big champions around that is from Australia, figuring out that feeding the seaweed to the cows bring down their methane in their farts. That's like the Ascaris. It's amazing. So those applications, you need a lot of biomass, and, you know, like the applications. And then you're going all the way to the top of the cosmetics and the pharmaceutical side. So you're looking at compounds ranging from, say, like $10 a kilogram to up to like $1,000 a kilogram. And that's just, you need the, you know, that structure of the biorefinery using every element of the plant in different extractions.
So if someone listening to this really would like to get into it, how can they be like you? You seem to be deeply into it, but what brought you there? How did you get there? And how could someone who's starting from scratch get to really be into seaweeds? Because it's such a distant thing, you know, it's out there in the ocean. It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's a question I asked myself recently. Why am I still whittling away at this? It's not for the faint of heart. It's been exciting and frustrating being at the forefront of a trend. I poured in all of my resources to kind of cling on for dear life. Just a gut feeling knowing that, eventually people, like you're saying, like, you know, the Elon Musk will sit up and pay attention. I would say it depends on the country that you're looking at. Like I mentioned, the getting into the space is quite challenging with the regulations and just the permitting around that. It's really a sticky situation because you're looking at applying for permits, and 2 years later, you're lucky if you can get your farm going. In the traditional business sense, like, how many people have 2 years of runway to wait for things to come through? There's a few of us that have been, you know, crazy enough to really just stick it out. For instance, in Canada, Cascadia seaweed is amazing. Michael and they've also very similar to me, just sticking it out. And now, you know, almost, I think they're, yeah, like round about the same timeline as me. Between 5 and 10 years is average in the seaweed space before you start heading somewhere. At the Earthshot Prize event, how do you pronounce his surname now? I cannot remember his surname. From Notpla. He was very amused at me knowing their business story with Notpla, and I was like, and this year this happened, and this year this happened, and he's like, wow, you really know our story. But I said to him, it's because it gives me hope that, you know, sticking it out and just there eventually you'll make that breakthrough. And I think things are, I want to say within the next, hopefully less than 5 years, things are going to start picking up because more people are now paying attention to it. You've got the range of activities where you can slot yourself in, from the actual farming side to where a lot of the countries do have some form of wild harvesting that's happening, that you can then buy from, you know, the local communities and then start making products from that. So yeah, that at the moment, that is one of the elements that I know the Global Seaweed Coalition is also working on, that dealing with the fragmentation of the industry, because that is one of the things that really need to be stabilized. Just having the traceability, already putting those foundations in place for the next phase where the carbon credits around the seaweed will be in place, and just giving that reassurance to people buying the seaweed that, you know, they it's not the system where the workers are exploited. That's why I love Clara's like story of just, you know, taking the seaweed and doing that, you know, value add and actually giving back to the people that helped her to get there. So yeah, I think a lot of people that are drawn to the industry does not have the usual business mindset. So I think that's an interesting thing that is popping up around it, which is great because it's like I said, we can't afford to go down the extractive route of what happened with all the other industries.
That's as much kelp and seaweed we could manage to put into one sustainable hour. Thank you very much to Nadia Scheffer, speaking to us all the way from South Africa. Nadia, if people want to get deeper into this in terms of, do you have a website or is there somewhere where people can get inspiration in this aspect?
So my local website for the South African activities is seaweedsouthafrica.co.za. And then finding the Global Seaweed Coalition will be the other element to just get involved more on the international side.
Excellent. We'll put the links in our show notes on climatesafety.info. Thank you very much, Nadia. We usually ask our guests in the end to have a thought about what you recommend our listeners and us, Tony, Colin and Mick, we should be. What should we be? Should we, you know, we used to say be the difference, but then we got tired of that. Someone told us, no, we shouldn't be the difference. We should be together. What do you say we should be?
I want to say be curious. We've created systems in the world that we've forgotten that we created them. And we just need a bit of curiosity to rethink the system. It's not rocket science. We don't have to go to Mars. To quote you on that one, we just need to be curious about what else is doable.
You have a choice to make: to become planetary guardians. Are you ready for change? Can you feel it in the air? Break down the wall.
Community in a beautiful place, and respect for all beings and nature, learning, growing together. The world is shifting, there's a change in the air. From coral reefs to the fields, we're all aware. The time has come to rise and connect. Lies and bad habits we've got to correct. Politicians say what they think we want to hear, but we see through their lies. We persevere, they think we're stupid. Prosperity. The kids are crying, they feel the weight of a world that needs our love to create. We hold on to our dreams, we don't buy their bait. We weave like fungi, we innovate. We are the guardians of tomorrow's way. We rise with the sun, a brand new day. We turn the tide, we change the story. Rebuild the world on trust and integrity. Hey, sunlight turned to energy. Clean and safe, and now it's free. To build the world we want to see. Put integrity before prosperity.
have a choice to make. Become planetary guardians.
I am an oak tree, and I have been waiting for ye to listen. I never needed my voice to be heard before, because for millennia, the world understood me without words. The deer sheltered beneath my canopy. The red squirrel trusted my branches. The fungi threaded themselves through my roots, like a nervous system, passing nutrients to my neighbors. We are not separate things. We are one conversation, ancient, fluent, and alive. But somewhere along the way, you stopped hearing us. You cleared the forests and called it progress. You drained the wetlands and called it development. You broke the soil and called it productivity. What we need you to understand, when you don't listen to the planet, you do not protect yourselves from nature's problems. You become them. The floods that devastate your homes. I could have held that water in my roots, in the wetlands, in the living sponge of healthy soil. The heat that kills your crops and stifles your cities. I could have cooled the air, shaded the ground, drawn down the carbon. You have a choice to make. To become planetary guardians and to elevate my voice. A guardian is not a manager. A guardian is not an owner. A guardian is someone who holds precious wonder for generations to come. So what do I ask of you? I ask you to give the planet a voice in every room where decisions are made. I ask you to connect your climate commitments to your nature commitments. To live within all the planetary boundaries, because a net zero world stripped of biodiversity, destruction of soils, chemical pollution, and the air pollution poisoning all of us is not a livable world. It's just a different kind of catastrophe, arriving more slowly. And I ask you to remember when the negotiations are difficult, when the compromise feels impossible, that somewhere right now, a root is growing. Somewhere, a seed is breaking open in darkness, trusting that the soil will hold it. Somewhere, a forest is breathing. Please let it breathe and listen. Do not give up on this wondrous planet. My name is Mary Robinson, but today, as a planetary guardian, I also speak with humility for the oak, the bog, the river, and the soil beneath your feet.